And it's a kind of moment to sort of pause, to kind of reflect on what we've been watching at sea level this morning. And the sort of topic under discussion is this idea of what it is to make film history with film, with the audiovisual, what it is to, you know, make this kind of film, this kind of television, but also then what happens when it gets sort of translated. And thank you very much, Julia, for that absolutely fascinating insight into the exhibition. And I was just completely, my knees were weak looking at all those questionnaires. It gives me great honour, because we don't actually often get to sort of welcome Michael Temple.
Yeah.
to the front. He's normally sort of bustling around. I'm sure most of you know who Michael is. Michael is the director of BME, but he's also sort of really the director of the festival as well, along with the wonderful Matthew Barrington, who has always conveniently disappears at these moments. So Michael is going to kind of offer a response to kind of what we've seen, and I've invited Julia back to the front, because I'm sure that there are going to be kind of questions, particularly in relation to her sort of wonderful talk. And Volker is here in the front as well, so he can chip in. Okay, so over to you, Michael.
Yes, okay. Well, I haven't really prepared anything. I should say that very honestly, because I think that rather than a kind of a long opening up a potentially vast discussion about what it means to make audiovisual film history, which strikes me as a pretty vast topic, I mean, we can say a few words about that. But I think my feeling is that given the way the day has unfolded, which is, as I was just saying to Janet, has been a very agreeable rhythm of, you know, some speaking, some watching, I felt really that this last half hour that we have, it would be good to also have just a discussion about what we've seen, thoughts and questions about the three episodes that we've seen so far, and also, you know, given that we have someone, you know, with us, and in fact also in the audience, people who've got a very sort of in-depth knowledge of this particular work, I'm assuming that there'll be people in the audience who might want to ask some relatively specific questions. I mean, in terms of this question of audiovisual history of cinema, I mean, my own connection with it, I suppose, if to be perfectly honest, does start with Histoire du Cinéma on the one hand. So, you know, for over a period of time, I was always interested in Godard's so-called videographic history of cinema, and followed that development very closely whilst it was sort of still being completed, and, you know, have kind of worked a little bit around that over the years. And then I think that, so for that, in a sense, that was my entry point, which is a very specific entry point into this notion of, well, what happens when cinema tells its own history, or when images and sounds tell the history of images and sounds. And in a way, that was my starting point, and I've always kind of, there's something restrictive, in a way, about coming through Godard, because then there's the idea that somehow you're only interested in approaches to that topic which might in some way be on the kind of experimental side to what one can do with images and sounds. And then I think, so I'll just park that and come back to that for a minute. But I think that what's very important to me is that that is by no means the only way of thinking about this. And my own way of approaching it would be to be not to be terribly hierarchical between what I would see as three modes of film telling the history of film. So these would broadly be the first mode. There's nothing mysterious about what I'm going to say. It's not kind of. I didn't go up onto a mountain and get this down. In fact, there were four tablets and I dropped one and it broke. So the three remaining ones were the first one would be what one might just simply call documentary approaches to the history of cinema. So as we all know, and this is for me is something that's come through as a teacher. You know, when I finally ended up teaching film in a film department, I found that one of I've just this inexhaustible stock of really interesting moving image accounts of the histories of moving image, and often things, you know, that were not at all, just stuff you find on the internet and so forth. And so for me, there's a very long tradition of relatively straight, relatively conventional historical accounts of cinema in moving image form, but they're not kind of made by necessarily by well-known directors or by people who have the kind of poetic status of someone like a Godard or someone like that. And for me, I think that when Volker was saying earlier on about there's so much work to be done, one area where there's definitely work to be done is just in that field of pretty kind of ordinary-looking work, film work, documentary work, about the history of cinema. So, I mean, for me, that would be sort of mode number one, would be to look at that. And, of course, I'm not saying that this fits in necessarily to that mode, but it isn't, nor is it totally separate from that mode. I think that there's a, what's interesting about this particular object is that if you set out, I'll mention what the two other modes would be, then this one would neatly fit into one of those. And I think that's interesting, but it doesn't in any way take away from the validity of these sort of three broad ways of doing it. The second way would be the more, if you like, experimental approach. So this would be whether it be found footage film. In other words, the whole thing that we do quite a lot of here, I suppose, which is a kind of experimental reworking of images and sounds from the history of cinema into new work. So, I mean, that's a kind of, in a way, the one that's probably, I would imagine, got the most attention by academics and researchers. But I would imagine that there again, there's also a lot of work still to be done. And certainly my kind of interest in something like, to go back to my starting point, Histoire du cinéma, that would obviously be somewhere within that second mode. And I suppose, again, in terms of what we've just seen, or what we're in the process of watching, I wouldn't say that the Strachek necessarily fits into that second mode either. I mean, I think it's probably closer to the first than the second. It's not a kind of experimentally led kind of project of kind of, you know, radically reworking this material into something that's somehow, you know, critical and strange. It's as I was saying to a couple of people during the break, I mean, it's eminently watchable.
It's TV.
Yeah. And then, of course, the third mode, which we don't need to talk about tonight, but I think it's one that bizarrely is the most obvious, or very obvious, but also never gets talked about, as far as I'm aware, which is how fiction, how dramatic fiction film explores the history of cinema. And it's an odd one. If I ever actually get round to doing any research, I would quite like to spend some time looking at that, because I think it is. Yeah, you know, and so, I mean, there are biopics, and these are becoming quite fashionable in the last two or three years, when there seems to be someone going around trying, how many subjects are there for biopics in the world? It's someone that seems to have a bet to see if they can exhaust the topics for that. But obviously the recent one, the Laurel and Hardy one, would be a very good illustration of that. But that, I think, is an under-researched area, which is what happens when a dramatic feature explores the history of cinema. So, you know, I mean, that might even be something like, which isn't necessarily a biopic, one of my favourite films in this mode is Le Silence d'Or, which is the René Clair film from, I think it's 1945, 1946, which is a kind of a dramatic feature film that happens to be set in the early days of cinema in France. It's got Maurice Chevalier in it. So those would be the sort of the three sort of broad, if we were going to have a sort of a broader discussion about what one would think about in terms of audiovisual history of cinema. So it strikes me that in a way the what's interesting about the Strachek is it strikes me that I would say it is closer to the first mode in a way. But in that, I think that Esan and I were maybe discussing earlier on when we were having a coffee. I mean, one thing that's interesting to me in relation to this, not as a sort of direct point of comparison, but it seems to me it's happening around the same time, is, for example, Kevin Brownlow's Hollywood series, which I'm getting a look from Ricardo. So. And if you've ever been looked at by it, it's a bit like Paddington Bear. You know, you get that, he gives you a stare, and it just does me in. But it's the Ricardo stare. But the Kevin Brownlow series, which is being made in parallel, and the reason why I say that is obviously, you know, Gunter Peter Strachek and Kevin Brownlow, you know, they may or they may not have share some things in common, I don't know, but one wouldn't necessarily think of them in principle as being with the same kind of philosophy or approach. But I do think there is something about the Hollywood series which is very interesting. One of which is that it has this sense of its duration in terms of the length of time that took to be made. So I did actually spend, in fact, on this very recording device, I bought it to sit down with Kevin Brownlow over a period of days. And I've got about 3 hours of interviews with Kevin Brownlow about the genesis and the evolution of the Hollywood series. So I don't know whether people know this series, the Hollywood Pioneers. It's a series that he made for Thames Television, which I think is also interesting in terms of the production context. So there it's not public television. But it grew out of, strangely enough, World at War. So World at War was made by the Thames Television, made with basically the fact that when you hear, what's his name, Isaacs, Jeremy Lord Isaacs, is he now? Mm-hmm. Talking about the history of this, I mean, basically commercial television had so much spare cash and was so conscious of the, I mean, literally they were famously had a license to print money, which is Lou Grade's famous term, which is a brilliant term. They had a license to print money, so they were literally just raking in the cash to such an extent. And they had a slightly bad conscience about the fact, well, if we're not seen to be doing stuff that is not kind of vulgar entertainment, then, you know, the state might get on our backs and start asking us to, you know, might kind of be more restrictive. So this is why they came up with these high-prestige cultural projects. So World at War was one of those. And it was off the back of the World at War that Brownlow got in contact with Jeremy Isaacs and said, look, I've always wanted to make this series about the history of Hollywood. And Isaacs basically bankrolled the whole thing, exactly in the same way that the World at War was bankrolled, which was that there was literally no budget, in the sense of it was an infinite budget. Nothing was ever written down about how much the thing would cost. So Hollywood is an interesting project insofar as it has this kind of long duration in terms of its the research that went into it. Because famously, Brownlow had done all the research and interviewed all the people before for purposes of doing a book. And then when he was able to make the series, he went back and, those who were still alive, went back and found them again and interviewed them. And I think what's interesting about, you know, Hollywood is so there's that sort of sense of a very, very long-term research project. The second thing is about the fact that Brownlow was very concerned to sort of dig up people who'd been totally forgotten. So it wasn't even necessarily, some of them very famous, the people that he discovered or rediscovered and went back and spoke to, but some of them had, you know, if you see some of the people who are interviewed in that series are totally minor figures in the history of cinema. They're not all sort of, you know, forgotten superstars. It's not sort of it's not that kind of setup at all. It's people who had very stuntmen, you know, cameramen, people who worked in various editors, people who worked in various branches of it. So, and I think the third thing that is interesting is also that I do maintain that Hollywood is beautiful, mm-hmm. in the way that one part of the fascination of what we are seeing today is that it is self-evidently beautiful. It's got this incredible, it's incredibly beautifully filmed. The framing, the fact that there is no cutting. In the interviews, or at least the person will reach the end of their sentence and there might be a little intertitle about some of their film work and you go back to it. But it's got, the reason why, well, when I first saw the first episode 2 years ago, the reason I think, well, I and many other people were just sitting there with our mouths open was just that it is just it's so simple and beautiful. And I think I'd actually maintain that would probably also be the case if you projected Hollywood by Kevin Brownlow. I think it is beautifully thought through. Brownlow is a very, very good editor. He's a super editor. And the mixture, obviously, with Brownlow is much more, it's a kind of a movement between editing of archive material and editing of interviews. But I think it's the interviews, obviously, which are shot very beautifully filmed, very carefully edited. I would imagine, shot in 16. I don't know. I would have thought probably would have been shot in 16 at the time. It's the care. It's the idea of something that's being made with a relatively straightforward documentary, pedagogical type of purpose, within a context of this is something that's going to be shown on television, something that's going to be shared with a very large audience, but is nonetheless put together with a great deal of thought and care. Even though, obviously, I mean, stylistically, there are many, many differences. And also there's something about the modesty, bizarrely enough, I think also possibly in relation to, in the sense that with the, you know, with Strashek, he's extremely discreet. You know what I mean? He's extremely discreet, and there's no, there's very little voiceover, but the voiceover is sort of quite modest, informative type of voiceover. It's not a voiceover that's sort of telling you, you know, this is what you should think about what you are seeing, in a way. And I think in a strange way there is that element again in Hollywood, even though Hollywood is quite a, yeah, again, probably a much more conventional piece of documentary filmmaking for television. But there is a certain kind of attention and care, not just to the form, but also I think to the people who are being interviewed, people who are being filmed. So that was kind of, you know, in the back of my mind. I was watching, I was thinking, well, is there anything, is this a one-off? Is this sort of like what the French called an ovni, you know, a kind of something that's fallen out of the sky, and it's just a kind of a one-off piece of work? And I think it probably is a one-off piece of work. But are there, if one were to look for comparisons or parallels, where would one look for them? Because, I mean, nothing is ever really a UFO, you know what I mean? I don't really believe in UFOs. But it has that. It, obviously, it's unique, it's singular, you can use all those words as much as you want. But I think that nonetheless, I think, and again, in terms of what Volker was saying this morning, in terms of research that one might want to do, I think there's also that sense of you'd want to sort of try to contextualise it in relation to other projects, which wouldn't be to say it's the same as, but just to give it something to compare it with, in a way. So, yeah. So that was my sort of general thoughts about how one could try to situate this in terms of a broader research agenda around audiovisual film history. Charles?
Sorry, it seems to me, maybe I'm fresh out of watching the films, but perhaps there's a certain unfairness to Strazek in trying to diminish his originality by trying to group him, by trying to link him to some other, immediately talking about his work in the context of, I mean, okay, there's a Brownlow connection, it happened here, perhaps, you know, his earlier film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But perhaps there's enough in the films that one could talk about having to bring
Absolutely.
In great other people.
Yeah.
I mean, no, I'm not
Charles,
trying to denigrate Brownlow's work.
No. It was simply that Janet asked me to, could you put this in some sort of context of other forms of audiovisual history?
Okay,
so
yeah,
as a pedagogue, I like to do things in threes. So I have seriously been thinking about this for some time. But I mean, so it's not in any way to diminish or denigrate or anything of the sort. But and in fact, the discussion, as far as I'm concerned, I'm very happy to have a discussion about just what we've seen, and as I said, details of what we've seen and reaction to what we've seen. But Janet was asking for some sort of sense of a broader research agenda,
agenda. I retract my objection. In that case.
Where's John Burko when you need him?
I mean, just to sort of add that it does seem that there was a sort of trend in the 70s, and just to add, with things like Parkinson, and there was a thing called Hollywood Legends, and I think it was partly because there was this generation who were passing, so there was a set.
Yeah.
So I'm just putting into that context, and even with World at War. You know, the sort of stories around that was that these people just wanted almost to confess, And the episode on Holocaust became infamous in the UK because it was like the first time all this sort of narrative.
Yeah, but why did Last Man make Shoah when he made Shoah? It was precisely because, particularly in France, and I know this through personal experience, through personal contacts of mine, there were so many people who'd been silent or very, very quiet about their personal experience. Those French Jews who'd been deported and come back, and I know personally several people to whom that happened. And there was a silence, there was a reluctance to talk about it for many, many years. And that realisation, I'm sure, that realisation, which is probably around that sort of 70s moment, which is also post Le Chagrin à Pitié, which is a key catalyst in this in France, absolutely key catalyst. It's a rare time when a film has actually totally changed historiography. Sorry, in the pity. Totally changed historiography. And there was a reaction, particularly amongst the Jewish community in France, that time was running out and that soon people wouldn't be there who could still talk about it. And that's why you get a flourishing, if that's the right word, of testimony and, you know, not obviously in terms of books and films and so forth being made around that time. So there is maybe that sort of sense of wanting to get people's witness testimony recorded whilst they're still here. And that's true in a completely different register with Brownlow. That, you know, when he talks about when he went round trying to find people, and they were saying, you know, I've just been living in this, you know, this bungalow in Texas for the last 30 years. No one's ever said to me, oh, you're the guy who was the stuntman in such and such. And yeah, he literally was kind of just, you know, digging these people up. And oh no, that's the wrong expression, digging these people up. He was literally, sorry, I didn't mean that, it wasn't meant to be funny. He was, and that's why he was so desperate to go back and then refilm the interviews, which I think they'd only done as audio originally when it was just for the book, when he got the money from Thames. So that idea of time running out and some of the very moving aspects, I think, of the interviews as well, again, it's, and this is true in Hollywood actually, is, you know, that sort of sense of people's, you know, people, you know, sharing things and obviously very, you know, very difficult experiences, but you also must be thinking in terms of memories as well. You know, I mean, people's memories fade. And you know, someone said to me one of the breaks that they thought that the people must have told these stories several times before. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I don't know objectively. Mm-hmm. But I, just as an instinct, I said, well, maybe not. You know, maybe not. Maybe it's not that they've told these stories many times before. Maybe it's that, in fact, they haven't told these stories for a very long time. And I think that there's an interesting sort of dramatic tension in some of those interviews.
Maybe.
The Fritz Lang, that is an exercise in mise-en-scène. I mean, that guy, with his own body, in one take, giving you a perfect exercise about space in cinema, just by the way he moves around the room. I mean, that's astonishing. But that's Fritz Lang, he's lying as well. But I mean, some of the other ones are much
more... That was someone else's film.
And it's very important, I think, that Straschek uses this Fritz Lang excerpt at the very beginning. And in the fifth last episode, there's also, he closes just after, here we saw the Führer give the city to the Jews, the Nazi propaganda film, and then we see Fritz Lang also exercising some kind of performance, let's say, at least. And the last episode finishes with all the people who went to concentration camp and were murdered. And before that, he has Fritz Lang also talking about the tragic of emigration, tragic of exile. And he's talking about the most tragic thing is that you lose your language.
Mm-hmm. I remember that. Yeah.
And then he quotes someone he calls, Münchhausen, I think. He quotes someone he calls an emigre.
Right.
And we researched this, and in fact, this guy was not an emigre, but a Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think Straschek must have known this. And it's so interesting that he puts Fritz Lang at the beginning and at the end. And this whole thing of staging memory, of knowing, I think this is very intelligent observation that these people have told these stories before, because I think the stylization that he uses in the images points exactly to this, that he is making people aware. And just in the last episode we saw Josef Tan tells the story of how he you know, he became very ill from Casablanca to Tangiers, and so, and then he caught the last ship to America. And when he says it, he smiles to Strašek, and he's like, "What I think it was the last ship." And you see, they have talked about this before, because all the emigres said they were on the last ship. And it's this part of, you know, oral history of people forming their history and, you know, dramatizing or whatever happens in oral history. The whole Shoah project of Steven Spielberg also works exactly with this kind of telling, you know. You have to, and Strašek was already at that time so aware that these stories are told in a certain manner, and he is talking to people whose profession it is to tell stories and to stage stories.
Yeah.
So I think this is really, it's really excellent how you...
Yeah, I mean, my only thought about that would be, I think what you said can be entirely true, but I also think the opposite might be true at the same time. I'm not sure, I wouldn't know, but I mean, my guess would be that that isn't necessarily the case across the board. I mean, I think that some of the... You can't be guaranteed that these were all stories that they had told over and over again. I think the Litvak, for example, Anatole Litvak, I didn't get the impression that he was... That was a story that he told before, not least because he was so desperately struggling to tell the story and lost his train of thought and which language he should be speaking in and several times. I mean, yeah, we all know that. I mean, the representatives of the Eisner family aren't here anymore, but Julia Eisner, who's Lotte Eisner's great-niece, was here earlier on with her son. And yeah, I get the feeling that some of the stories that Lotte tells, she's told many times before. And but I don't know. I mean, as I say, I don't think it's necessarily black and white. I think you can have a nuanced sort of view of it. I think there's some you can... I wouldn't be so sure.
But any story you tell is a recollection and it is something, you know, it's a narration. And I think that's what he wants to make conscious.
Yeah.
And I think the comparison to Shoah by Fritz Claude Lanzmann is very interesting in this aspect. Also that you said, you were right, people were not telling their stories, and that's the accomplishment of Claude Lanzmann. That he...
Well, Lanzmann would claim that because he was an arrogant bastard. Apart from
no, but
I mean,
in the film, he
picks up on a cultural moment. Which
he talks to different people, you know? He doesn't talk to people who had a job in the film industry and just were emigres, but he talks to people who went to concentration camps. It's, you know, it's different, really different stories.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, he talks from a different perspective to them than Strašek does.
Absolutely.
Well, anyway.
Absolutely. No, the only reference to Shoah wasn't to say that it was like Shoah. It was to say that it's that idea of people disappearing in the sense of the timing of it. The timing of it is a sense of these subjects may not be here in 5 years, 10 years' time. So there's that sense of catch them while we can still get that story.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But I wouldn't know. I think it would be very crude to sort of start talking about Shoah and film emigration as somehow being, in that sense, comparable at all. Sorry.
Yeah, I just at the end of the third episode, I haven't seen the whole series, but at the end of the third episode, I started to get a strong sense of the film not so much as oral history, but as some kind of reinscribing the history into film history.
Yeah.
So that actually what we're seeing isn't a history of film, but history through cinema. So it's not necessarily film history we're watching.
That's... It's what we would call a cultural... It's what people would now call either like cultural film history or film culture, which I think is, in a sense, the bigger picture comes in through a discussion of how cinema, of the life of cinema, as it were.
I think it would be interesting in that perspective, and also to understand what he was doing, to know a bit more as about Strašek as actual film historian and his ideas about historiography, because we keep forgetting his book, which is an incredible, very impressive book about a counter film history. It's called A Handbook Against Cinema, and it's sort of like, as far as I could read it, it maps all sorts of practices of film all over the world, from every country, every European country, every country in the world, basically, and sort of like tries to establish a basic bibliography, a filmography, and always explain the history of cinema in each country from a social and political point of view. So I think there is a very, very precise idea of what film history or a counter film history could be. So maybe for I have this curiosity from if you could tell me more about the book, how it was conceived, how it was researched, because it's overwhelming the type of information it provides in the book, and I don't know much about how he was able to research.
Straub's helped him.
Probably there's a lot of help in that book because it's almost inhuman, impossible to do, to in the time and the scope that he wrote that book, to do so much research and to have seen so much. But there's something there which is quite sorry.
Could you say what more, because I don't know much about this book.
Yeah, exactly. If we could talk about just the book, if you know a bit more about it, and where does it situate itself in with other works?
I mean, it was one of those projects that took very long. I think he had almost completed the manuscript in 1771, and then it took several years. It was with Surkamp, like a very big and influential publishing house. Then it took 2 or 3 years where they never really got to print it, and they wanted him to make revisions, etc. And basically, as Ricardo said, I mean, there's several chapters on, like, I don't know, European film history, then US America, socialist countries, etc. And it's so detailed that it's kind of hard to read. It's more or less meant also, I think, as a kind of encyclopedia. It does have an index, etc. But there's also parts that are really like towards a socialist film practice. So very much informed by what had happened at DFFB and this moment where he is really heading towards something like a materialist view on film history and then also a socialist film practice. And it's one of those books which is really that's kind of an ovni somehow in the publishing landscape, and I don't know how much it really has been discussed at the time. I think there were lots of people who kind of dismissed it completely, also for its political standpoint, its position that it took, I mean, Strachek kind of once the book was published, that was in 1974. And then he did this, and then he went to London. I think he kind of abandoned also this as a field. He turned completely towards the film emigration project. So I'm not really sure Stefan Ripplinger would know more about it, because he has written on this in the catalog as well. But it seems like a very, very detailed and very well-informed and maybe unique film history from this point of view.
But it's not an aesthetic film history.
No.
I mean, it's a question.
No.
I don't know.
No.
It's not a history of film in the sense of... And for a long time, film history meant just putting together films in chronological order and saying, yes, evolution of a film language.
It's a bit like here,
so
I mean...
It's much more of a kind of political history of film.
I was just bringing it up because of the complexity of the ideas that it puts. It seems that film immigration tries to develop very... Because as Redmond was saying, I think there's something here at play that makes it quite different from Brownlow and other people I like very much, but that's... makes it in itself something which is also about what does it mean to talk about film history in a very different and sort of like way. So as we've seen, the way that every episode moves into a different structure, and after you'll see the five ones, and you really have a sort of a whole idea of how complex it is, what type of repetitions there are between people that return, what type of movements there are, camera movements inside the shots of some interviews. There's sort of something that... sort of grows, that it's more than just a discourse around what's happening.
But it's very polemic, so it's a handbook on one side, but it's not a neutral history, and he doesn't want to write a neutral history of cinema, and because he has a mission. He wants to write a materialist history, because he thinks this hasn't been there before. And basically... it's all already in the film Emigration, when he talks about the unions and that they become a problem for the writers or the lighting people, because they're not proceeding their political scope anymore, but just keeping people to their profession or just protecting the profession. This is a part, for example, in the filmmaking and in the book, and for example, also how the production of Hollywood is also in here, where he says, it's a myth that the films that European filmmakers made in America after their immigrations are worse than these that they had done before. Actually, the production system in Hollywood is a good one because it's already on a high level, production level. So he's trying to look at things from a different perspective, and he's trying to readjust film history and to tell it differently.
I mean, in some ways, it seems to me, you know, when you're talking about when we did Strasher the other day, you know, I mean, if you and I don't know this sort of moment as well as you guys do, but I mean, the combination of taking form seriously, take form seriously as form, okay, and have a critical engagement with the forms of cinema. And with a politically informed materialist, or whatever you want to call it, politically informed take on what it means to be historical. That's it. Yeah. I mean, that's it. In that sense, it makes, you know, it is very, although the idea of someone with that, you know, background turning to this particular topic, and then the kind of the scale of it, you know, and the kind of the desire to go on and on and on, and not just make a film, but make this sort of a potentially, I suppose, infinite series of films. That's maybe extraordinary, but the fact that it has that combination of formal curiosity or taking form seriously as form and a left-informed political critique in its approach to history, I mean, that seems to me that's it. Really. There's nothing astonishing about that. Actually, Galatia, didn't you want to say something a minute ago? I saw you putting your hand up.
Yeah, it was when you were talking about Anatoly Ptak. He had this nervousness that looked like maybe it was a bit difficult to talk about it, but then there was the other testimony from the actress that she's sitting in front of the mirror.
Camila Spira.
Yeah, and at the end she says, is that what you wanted to know? Yeah. You know, she has performed her story. She talks about being a voice group as well, you know, like as a very traumatic story, but I had the sense that she had told that story many times, and then she confronts also the interviewer in a way that, is that the evidence that is going to make it into...
Well, except, I would argue, though, again, filmically speaking, though, the fact that she then asked that question, to some extent, that's the sort of... that keeps it open. Because if we're doing this, and then if we had just rehearsed this conversation we were having, Alessia, in the cafe, and we were pretending it was spontaneous, and then when I got to the end of it, I looked stupid. Then that would add a different element of reflexivity to it, wouldn't it? And I think her question back to Strasher behind the camera introduces a reflexive element to it. Yeah. So it kind of maybe proves that she's told it many times before. Maybe she's seeking his approval. Is that kind of the sort of thing you wanted me to say? I don't know. So I think it's a very, I mean, that's what's so wonderful about it. It's a very open object. Sorry, so there was Emma and there was Maren.
Mine, just a quick one about the connection with broadcasting and how much Strasek was interested in other medium, because obviously we talk about history of film, but this is made for television, we talk about it in terms of television history, and then you see that, you know, at least one of the emigres has worked for BBC, and we know how much people went in to work for broadcasting as well as film all through the 30s onwards. So I just wondered in his books and in the archive if there's anything, if he's very much focused on film, on the materialist political use of film, or if he's got a broader opening for things like radio and television in particular, which is actually what made this piece for.
There are a few things that he has done for radio. Yeah. There's one, and I think at the time of Film Immigration, he also does a radio. It's not a radio play, but like a feature, a longer feature. And then there's another one on libraries later in the 1980s, two-part thing. What's the title? Triff mich mal im Lesesaal or something? Like meet me in the library or something? About different libraries and how they function. So again, the whole topic of, recollection, etc., how to, is quite present. And I think for this, it's quite crucial that it's being shown on television and not just like to people who are interested in it in any way, and I mean 9:15 p.m. is quite prime time. It's prime time TV on Tuesdays each week, and so people could be exposed to something that they hadn't expected at the time. And I think it's.
I was just wondering, Emma, but weren't you also talking about the content whether he his research extended into the world of people working in TV and film and radio.
Was, that, was, that our, you know, our history,
was it only people who is it, only, is it exclusive, was he exclusively interested in people who worked in film, or was he interested also in people who'd gone who'd emigrated and then end up working in TV or radio or
In this in his research, which started exactly when this film was finished. He was researching everything. That's what my Volker said, you know.
Yeah.
Did he also research the people who watched the films? Because the book was to have two categories. First, the people who were actually directly involved in filmmaking, and then the broader group was people who were also doing film or maybe even television or radio, but they had a connection, a loose connection to film. And actually, when you go to the archive with these 2,800 files, it's really an archive on emigration. And so there's everything, because he researched the whole family, you know, in order to know if this person was really the person, like, or if it's just the same name as somebody else. He had to find out the whole family tree, pseudonyms that he decoded and everything. But he wasn't so much into television history, I would say. I don't think that was something he was...
More radio, yeah. Okay, yeah. Thank
you. I think, Maren, you wanted to say something.
In relation to the scene with the actress, Shibira, when she asked him, you know, is this what you wanted to know? Or what of this is of interest to you?
Could you maybe speak a bit? Oh, just sorry.
Yeah, in the scene with the actress that asked him, what of this is of interest to you? And then he actually, his question then is, well, I'd be interested to know whether the head of the camp would have known whether this Aryan proof is a fraud or not, and she thinks, you know, he would have known. So there, I find it interesting that he seems to be interested particularly more in something like what were the possibilities of people to give people some sort of route of escape. And I think that pops up all through. And that just made me think, when it was shown on television at the time, I would have been interested. Obviously, it was commissioned by the film unit and broadcast on the third channel, but that I wonder when it was shown how much more important actually was that it was a an investigation into the history, a more general history, how specific actually at the time it was to see it as being film history or just some one strand in this aspect of German history. So I don't know, I didn't express this very well. I don't know, is that clear?
Yeah. I think it's the model case for him, the film industry, but of course he's interested in German history and how it can be told, and there he is a member of 1968, and you know, some of his colleagues in the DFFB did the same. You know, they went to research what their fathers did, basically, or their parents did, and they made films about this. A lot of them went into, the members of the SDS at least, went into this kind of, they used their filmmaking tools in order to explore history.
Yeah, I mean, the, again, it's maybe a completely inappropriate parallel, but it just strikes me. I mean, if you're making a film about black music, like jazz, for example, of the 50s and 60s and into the 70s, you're also making a cultural history that doesn't normally get told of the United States of America. You know, so you know, we showed a beautiful film about Horace Tapscott last year at the Essex Film Festival, and that was a film about music, the history of music, obviously, because it's, you know, a great music, a very rich musical tradition, but it was also an incredible lesson about what it means to be politically committed as a black artist in the 1960s, you know. So, I mean, that's why I was saying about the kind of cultural history, in a way, as a way of it's both about the artistic practice, but it's not
distinct
from those kind of projects. Not if you've seen, well, the Horace Tapscott film we showed last year was as much a film about the history of America.
It's aware of its own staging in a way that I haven't seen that film, so I'm not sure.
But we have to remember it's 1975 in Germany. Until 1968, Germany was still the fascist state. You know, you had the same people who were working in the offices and in the ministries and in the academies and in the professors at the university that have been there before, and only in 1968 it started to change. Mm. And that was the audience. I mean, you have to, the general audience, TV audience in Germany, knew nothing about this. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want to know anything about it until Strachek and his friends came to tell them the story.
Well, that would be the chagrin et pitié moment.
I mean, I didn't know. I mean, didn't mean it was a fascist state, but you know,
it's not a state.
Yeah, but that's why
Hitler was gone. But it was, and there was a democracy, obviously. But yeah. You understand what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it was the same in France.
You know, if there's always an epistemology that sort of is the condition for doing anything. Because Volker mentioned that there was a, you know, like public thinking was important, and there was a particular moment which was legal, political, economic, that allowed a certain kind of epistemology, a new episteme, a counter episteme to emerge, which allowed these practices, you know, these art students to do what they did, and their practices to go on for a lifetime, because you say it was an intense, lifelong ethical and political commitment, trying to understand what happened, you know, because everything changed with the Holocaust. We don't think of what it is to be human in the same way. Enlightenment has shifted forever. It's an attempt to understand something like that, and I just wonder if you could say something about that. I mean, maybe you've said it already, but you touched on it, Volker, in your talk about this moment that was legal, political, and economic.
I mean, my angle would be, I think, to try about ways to account for the role that public television and certain people within public television, certain structures played. And I think the whole idea of auteurism that we have, also, which is very prominent in the idea of the essay film. So people sometimes say it's the auteurist version of documentary. That's the essay film. But of course, there's a lot of Strachek in this, but I think it's interesting also to think about how there's lots of other types of authorship or responsibilities involved, not only the commissioning editor, but also someone at the head of WDR who didn't particularly like lots of things that happened there, but who was still open and thought, okay, I have the experts, they will know what they will do. I don't like it, but they will know. So there was this spectrum of possibilities, which I think it would be interesting to see, okay, what kinds of authorship are involved there. And there's, I mean, all the people that are interviewed, of course, are authors, or they author their own particular small stories, and all this comes together, and this space kind of gets diminished and narrower towards the 1980s, and a lot of this has to do with private television, etc., which is quite late in Germany, I mean, this doesn't really address your question straightforwardly, but I think, and also like very specific German aspects of it, like this term Bildungsauftrag, that all this public service television broadcast, they have like a legal mission to be educational. They have to devote a certain percentage of their program to educational programs, and for people in the film redaktion, for instance, this was always the way to sneak in all these film educational programs about film history, or even this would probably qualify for this. So there was something, I mean, public television had a certain responsibility that they took seriously for a while. I think it still exists in on the
they
paper.
They also had the mass audience. I mean, that's the thing, is that you know, until the 80s, when the audience really does fracture, you know, you are speaking to mass audiences.
Yeah,
so
yeah, that's true.
But it's going against the grain of, it seems, from what you're saying, Julia, that it, in 60, that moment was going against the grain of what actually led to Nazism and which remained after the war. And it took a long time to kind of unravel that and to work it through and to deal with it.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose your show must be still an attempt to kind of deal with that history.
Yeah.
Or not?
Yeah. Probably.
When did Strasek leave Germany?
In 1975 he moved to London, and then from London to Vienna, and from there to Shanghai and to Delhi, and then back to Vienna.
Because all these filmmakers, they were very close to him, Peter Nessler, Straubli, etc. They all moved out also because of the very strong anti-communist stance, for example, and those things were shifting a lot right, at a certain period there. So in 1975, this is also very important.
Maybe a last question.
Okay, you get the last question, Patricia.
Well, I was just wondering because, I mean, a lot of times the voiceover questions the testimony. I mean, but that is a very, in a subtle way. For instance, like when he says that the earlier immigrants were not welcoming so well the later ones, the later comers, and then this the testimony saying the woman said, like, no, just everyone wanted to help, but in fact not everyone could help. And I thought that was interesting because you talk about this construction of memory. So there's a lot of points that are, it's very subtle, but that he kind of questions this some of the testimonies. But I also was wondering about, because this is not just about a film about German history, but the way that the immigrants were received by the hosting countries. And it also actually kind of, in that sense, it kind of not really contradicts, but it kind of tries to show this kind of, you know, third way of looking and opposing the ally version of the story. You see what I mean? Like, so I thought that was kind of interesting to kind of have all this ambiguity. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
I think I'm with you 100%. And I think that's also why it's for us so interesting still to watch it, because it's our present history, you know. We are the countries now that we receive these refugees, and we always, I mean, that's, I ask myself the whole time, you know, how I'm in the other position now. And that's how, why it's so still so
rhetoric of the good immigrant, because it seems that these people were like, it was random, like the, I mean, there were some people coming in that already had like a, you know, a professional career, but he also seems to imply that it was random. So I think I thought that was the most interesting thing, like in comparison to what is happening now, about this idea of like, oh, but you see what happened, like, but there were so many good professionals coming to
the doctors,
you know, like,
And I think that's also why he needed 5 hours, because it's not one history, but it's, you know, oral history is because many people talk, and then at the end, you are the viewer to, you make up your own mind, and you remember also what was important to you out of these 5 hours.
So I believe that we should be thinking about heading from this part of London to South Kensington. Those of you who are going to join us for the next... Yeah, there is a coach outside.
Horse-drawn.
I hope so, Charles. I thought you and I might take a little trot across the park. So thank you for everyone for coming. Thank you for especially to Julia and Volker for being such wonderful... As always, so elegant and clear and wonderful stuff. And also thank you to Janet and Ricardo for designing such a brilliant day. Thank you.